You're listening to Energy Insiders, a weekly update on clean energy and climate policy with Renew Economies editor Giles Parkinson and leading energy analyst David Leach. Energy Insiders is brought to you by Evergen, providing cutting-edge energy management software for battery optimization, virtual power plants and distributed energy resources. And Pylon, helping solar installers and retailers design high-resolution solar proposals in minutes.
Hello and welcome to this latest episode of the Energy Insiders podcast. My name is Giles Parkinson. I'm the editor of Renew Economy and its associated websites, the EV Focus, the Driven, and the Behind the Meter Focus, One Step Off the Grid. And joining me as usual is ITK principal David Leach. David, I trust you are well. It's been almost a fortnight since we last did this.
Yes, Giles, I'm well. Trust all our listeners are well. I'm just back from out back South Australia where it was incredibly hot and windy, but pleasure to be back. And what a humdinger of an interview we have today.
Look, we do. I am tempted to ask more about what you're doing out in the hot and windy Western New South Wales, but you probably don't want to tell me. But anyway, we have got a great interview this afternoon. We interviewed the head of Rio Tinto's sort of renewable transition plan in the Pacific, Vic Selvaraja, fresh from announcing the two biggest renewable power purchase agreements in Australia. Anyway, we caught up with Vic early today, and this is what he had to say. Vic Selvaraja, thank you very much for joining the Energy Insiders podcast.
Thanks for having me, Giles. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Well, I'm glad we got you on board, and thank you very much for listening. We had 1 million downloads on the podcast in each of the last 2 years, so that's pretty exciting. But enough of us bragging. Rio Tinto's turn to brag. You've had a couple of solar farms in Australia, a small one up in Weipa, and I think the Gudai Dare. I think that's probably I've probably got the pronunciation wrong. Over in the Pilbara, now you're looking to repower your smelters and refineries in Queensland, and you've gone out and landed a couple of landmark contracts in the last couple of months. Not just any old wind and solar contracts, you've gone for the biggest ever seen in Australia. Which should cause the biggest or the first gigawatt-scale solar project to be built up at Calliope, and also a 1.3 gigawatt wind farm, the Bungaban wind farm.
1.4 gigawatts, of which Rio's contracted 80%.
Thank you for that clarification, David. Why so big, Vic?
They're massive because of the scale of our load in Queensland. You know, we, across our three assets in Gladstone, we have a 10 terawatt hour annual electricity load. So it's just, that's the scale of project that we need to get into to make a meaningful difference in terms of decarbonizing the electricity supply that feeds our assets. And, you know, we're just getting started, right? There's another 30 terawatt hours to fill in that hopper from where those first couple of projects have gone in to decarbonize the electricity supply to our Boyne smelter, to our Tomago smelter, and over time to an increasing electricity load at our alumina refineries as we electrify them.
So let's just go back to understand why it is that Rio Tinto wants to decarbonize its electricity supply.
Well, I mean, I think we don't see any alternative, right? I mean, to start with, the energy system that these assets were built around in the 70s and 80s was an energy system of the time, in a large-scale thermal plant, coal-fired power stations, built, in that era. And we're coming to the end of the life of these assets. You know, Gladstone Power Station, which feeds, currently a significant share of our smelter, it's over 50 years old. And, you know, at some point in the future, you know, that asset is no longer going to be with us. And, we need a new electricity system, fundamentally, in this country, and that's what we're trying to incentivize the construction of through our long-term offtake contracts.
Is it a big leap for Rio Tinto then to move from sort of an old centralized fossil fuel-based system, based around base load energy, basically? I mean, you could probably sort of rely on that sort of coal-fired generators to be there, we are told. Now you're going and making this leap into sort of wind and solar, sort of backed up with dispatchable generation, of more of which we'll come to later on. Is that a bit of a sort of a challenge for you guys in the way that you're sort of thinking about the electricity systems? Because, you know, if we hear some of the detractors from our sort of, you know, the Australia and the globe's renewable energy sort of transition plans, they go, well, that can't work because it's not going to power big business and big industry. But you seem to be happy enough to go with that. Can you explain why?
Well, I mean, I think it's required us to really challenge a lot of the old thinking that we had, both in our organization and in the industry, right? You know, we've always gone to, you know, a large, you know, equivalent of a gentailer all around the world. And we've said, give us a 20-year contract, firm, flat, and, you know, however, whatever assets feed that. And that's been someone else's problem managing the system. I think, you know, the scale of our load in Australia means that we're having to step into the breach and fill in some of the gaps in the transition and take on some of the risks and challenges. Is it ideal? Probably not. But is it what we need to do to deliver a value creative solution for our business? I think it is. And certainly on a technical level, you know, we think that highly renewable, you know, wind and solar based electricity system is something that can meet the needs of our business, you know, backed up with storage and other forms of firming. So I think, you know, we're sort of pretty confident about that.
One more question for me, and I'll hand over to David then. What's the main driver of this then? Is this price? Is this emissions? Is it both?
I think it's both, right? And it's about asset life and asset continuity, right? At the end of the day, these smelters were built at the same time as the power stations. The power stations are coming to the end of their life. We want these smelters to keep going. They're such an important part of the regional economy and the community in places like Gladstone and the Hunter. And, you know, they produce aluminium, which is a key input into the energy transition. You know, can't make solar panel frames without aluminium. And we certainly support, you know, countries like Japan and Korea with their aluminium supply in significant part coming from Australia. And so we think there's a really exciting future for these assets, but to do that, you know, we need new energy systems to be built. You know, it's emissions, it's price, but it's also really about the future of this industry.
Vic, I guess I went to another seminar a couple of years ago where a Rio spokesman said that Rio was probably the biggest corporate buyer of electricity in the world. And I guess it must have been a question for Rio whether to repower these assets in Australia, which, as you say, are as old as the coal stations that are, or to go to where you have big interests somewhere like Canada and expand those. So I guess my question is, do you think, it's two part. Part one is, do you think a renewable powered smelter can be competitive on electricity cost, which is the main differential with smelters elsewhere in the world that run on coal? And secondly, is it a good idea to repower old existing assets or to build new ones?
It's a really tough question, David, but I'm glad you asked it. I mean, I think those are the exact kinds of questions that we've wrestled with as a business. I mean, we start from the position that, you know, these assets are, you know, they're brownfield assets. They're in places where there's a significant, you know, community around them, the strong community support for these assets to continue. And you know, we employ, you know, thousands of people in Gladstone, and that's really the starting point for us. And then we're not a charity. We have to ensure these assets are competitive on the global scale. And I think to that question, we think the landscape of industrial policy in lots of countries is shifting, right? And I think that means that, you know, absent subsidies and equivalizing for kind of emissions policy, if you wanted to put it that way, you know, we think a renewable powered aluminium industry in Australia is globally competitive. Now, you know, that's sort of is a bit of a mealy-mouthed answer, but, you know, I think that there is a genuine competitive pathway for Australian aluminium production in the long term. That doesn't mean that there aren't challenges in the immediate transition, right?
I've always believed that. I've always believed that in the absence of subsidies, China importing coal from Australia is going to end up with a higher electricity price than Australia on the energy side from the wind and the solar, because this is where we start to get interesting, in the sense that we know the wind and the solar can be cheaper than new coal generation. I think that's beyond question. But, of course, an aluminium smelter is designed to run on a very flat load. And the firming side of things is something that always comes into question. And I know you've thought a lot about it. How do you think about the firming task for the smelter going forward?
Look, I think that that's the big challenge, right? You know, we certainly see that Australia has really competitive, options in new wind and new solar development, where I think, you know, we do see a significant challenge on the economics is on the firming side of the picture. You know, we have very, very high gas prices in Eastern Australia, and that's, of course, in some of the competing regions that we compete with in the aluminium industry, particularly the Middle East. You know, that that headwind is obviously not there. We think storage has to play a very large role in Australia, and you know, I think the economics of that are getting more compelling by the day. But you know, we're still probably a fair way off them being, you know, genuinely competitive against, for example, you know, the kind of depreciated hydropower assets that exist that can be reused for firming in places like China. So there is an economic tension here as we build a new system in Australia as to who carries the cost of that new system, especially in the transition. But I think that, you know, we've got the right ingredients on the firming side of the picture with storage and potentially a small amount of thermal peaking plant to bring the picture together.
And of course, if I look at where this wind farm and solar farm that's for the Boyne Island smelter, and I think the combined output of what you've contracted is about 60% of the energy that Boyne Island requires over a year. Is that about right?
I mean, that's not too far off. I mean, we're sort of thinking about all of our assets in Gladstone, not just Boyne Island, but... Yeah, so the, you know, these two projects collectively, that's, you know, it's sort of around the 5 terawatt hour mark, and Boyne Island, at full capacity consumes just north of 8 terawatt hours. So 60% is just about right.
And the other assets that Rio owns in Gladstone, and I think Gladstone's a terribly interesting place. The Climate Council has talked about these industrial complexes. And Rio is by far the biggest corporate in Gladstone, I think, even allowing for the LNG players, which is a completely separate topic. But the refineries run on gas at the moment. I don't want to ask about this too much, but I was interested in your comment that is there going to be more electricity at the refineries as well? I mean, how does that fit in?
Yeah, I mean, certainly we look at the decarbonisation journey of the alumina refineries as one where additional electrification of raising process heat is going to be key, right? So we certainly see a pathway of load growth there over time as we, you know, reduce the use of coal and gas directly combusted on site and replace that with electrically generated process heat, you know, right? But that'll be kind of, you know, a decadal project. Right?
Yes, because I think I actually wrote something about this, and it seemed to me that the running the boilers at the refineries would actually take at least as much electricity as running the smelter, but they have the terrific advantage of being flexible if it could be run. But anyway, that's a separate topic. And what about to be an exporter of, how do you, one of the hardest questions, I was talking to someone the other night and I said about all this, and I said, you guys don't even know enough to ask me the tough questions. And they said, well, what is the tough question? And I said, the tough question is to understand what Australia can replace its coal and gas exports with. when we're running on clean energy. You know, Rhea, how do you see that green aluminium, for instance, it doesn't really command a price premium, does it? How can we take advantage of being green?
Well, look, I'm going to defer to my colleagues commercially on whether green aluminium commands a price premium. I think there's lots of different views about that in the market. We're certainly working with customers who are absolutely demanding that the aluminium be green. Their willingness to pay for that continues to vary and evolve over time. But I think, you know, you've asked some really challenging questions there, right? Which is about, you know, what do we think about the long-term export opportunity from Australia? I think that the starting point that we have is actually Australia already does export electricity, right? We already do export electricity actually in really significant quantities. It's just embedded in physical aluminium that we sell around the world. And that economic opportunity, I think, is one that is, you know, we can certainly sustain into the long term. And with the right conditions, I think grow that, you know, whether that's exactly in aluminium or in other such energy, electricity intensive industries, I think the potential is certainly there. But I think it also comes back down to a bunch of societal choices, right? You know, it really is about, you know, is Australia willing to incentivize the development of, you know, low carbon, renewable energy powered industrial assets at scale? And then, you know, if we're willing to do that, then I think those industries will get developed here, and we will be able to, significantly enhance the economic contribution of that type of industrial activity, and also sell low carbon products globally. And I think that's absolutely, you know, something that's within the reach and capability of Australia. And, you know, but it does come down to, you know, are Australians ready to act at the scale that's needed, you know, to compete in what is a global marketplace on this?
Yes, against clearly subsidised production around the world, and against, frankly, countries like Russia that, if they chose to, could greatly expand their hydro aluminium. But I don't want to talk about that too much. I'd like to stay in Australia. And I'll, before handing back to Giles, I'll just ask one more difficult question. It's fairly natural for company management to start by looking at one facility and decarbonising it. But I recently spoke at the Smart Energy Conference, and I said the single thing I would like people to do is to focus more on the link between Queensland and New South Wales, because when you're running a big wind portfolio, the wind in Queensland runs at a different time to the wind in New South Wales, and you can firm it. You need less firming. Now, Rio doesn't own 100% of the Tomago smelter, and it clearly has decided, and very sensibly, to look at Gladstone, Boyne Island first. But from where I sit, it seems to me that if the federal government looked at it from a national perspective rather than a state government or Rio looking at it from a state perspective, you might even get a more economic solution overall for the two smelters. So this is a very theoretical idea, which probably full of a million practical difficulties, but would you care to comment?
I mean, we certainly see and agree that, you know, a diverse portfolio of renewable resources tapping into different kinds of resources that exist in different parts of the country can deliver the lowest cost outcome. You know, as you're already seeing, you know, we're contracted a solar project in central Queensland, but a wind project in southwest Queensland. And the next projects we contract will also add more regional diversity into our portfolio. Contracting across state lines, you know, especially between New South Wales and Queensland, where we have a very, very small transmission connection and therefore quite significant price separation between the two regions, to use a too technical term, means that, you know, we're effectively taking on an enormous amount of basis risk by trying to hedge one load in one state with generation in another state. And thus far, we're not really seeing the economics support that kind of basis risk. But, in the future, I mean, especially if the interconnection between Queensland and New South Wales is improved and expanded significantly, it should, you know, all things, all else being equal, deliver a lower cost outcome to consider a portfolio across both states to serve the loads of assets across both states.
One of the great tragedies of the renewable energy transition is that we don't actually get to see the contract prices signed between sort of consumers, customers like you, and the developers. I mean, you're welcome to sort of break that now, and I'm sure that the New Economy, the Energy Insiders podcast, would be the place to do that. But failing that, were you sort of surprised? I mean, we've heard that solar modules have fallen in prices, sort of down around record lows, quite extraordinary falls actually in the last 6 months and 12 months. We've heard that wind energy costs rose around about COVID and haven't really come down that much, and there's a lot of competition for the materials and the supply. Were you pleasantly surprised by what you were offered when you put these projects out to tender?
Look, I think we worked with our development partners over an extended period of time to really get the projects well understood and sufficiently characterized that we'd have confidence that when we went ahead with the contracts that the projects could actually get delivered. And when I mean delivered, I mean both technically delivered but also commercially viable for the developers, right? Because I don't want to sign PPAs that actually, you know, is at a price that means that at the end of the day, the developer can't deliver and they walk away from the project, right? That's a terrible outcome for us. So having said that, I think that, you know, we certainly have seen wind project costs and therefore PPA prices for wind projects be much higher through the COVID period. But I think there's a bit of normalization underway at the moment. And you know, in the long term, in the medium to long term, I think we certainly do see, you know, the expansion of the industry continuing to drive costs down. You know, financing is actually one of the things that has driven the costs up really significantly. You know, that's also that interest rate environment being something that, you know, most people anticipate to come down.
Yeah.
Should also drop project costs a bit.
And I suppose the project developers can go to the bank and say, Mr. Rio Tinto has signed this big contract. Would you give us low cost finance? And the answer should be yes, I suppose. But
we hope.
Yeah, there you go. One of the people I think took part in your tender, and they said, well, they had a fully permitted project and sort of raised their eyebrow. I don't know whether it was sort of seriously or just, you know, they knew they lost anyway, because one of your projects hasn't even got development approval. Is that because this particular project offered lower costs, or because you're not in that much of a hurry because you are looking at like the end of the decade type of thing?
Yeah, I mean, we are in a hurry in the sense that, you know, we want to get our we want to get access to the best projects, and we take a holistic view of what a good project is. It's not just what level of approvals you've got. It's actually about where you're interconnecting into, you know, does how much network curtailment risk exists at that point, how much economic curtailment risk exists because of the generation profile of your project. And you know, are you providing us with a compelling price, right? You know, all of those factors go into it. That's not to say that we didn't take a very, very good, long, hard look at the approvals pathway for the projects that we have put have brought forward, and for any project that we're engaging with. And we take, you know, we take a reasoned perspective, right? We look at a project and we say, you know, is there anything here that was going to be a fundamental deal breaker for this project to get all the approvals that it needs? If there isn't, then we're happy to work with the development partner over an extended period of time to bring that project to market.
You've alluded a couple of times in this podcast to the sort of the challenge for dispatchable energy and the costs of that. And you've said, I think, in your public announcements that Rio Tinto has landed these 2 gigawatt scale projects, but it won't be doing any more until it understands better what sort of support it will get from state and federal governments over the dispatchable energy. And as you've mentioned, it could be storage, I guess, or it could be gas or whatever. So can you just maybe talk a little bit more about what you're trying to sort of hear from state and federal governments? I mean, you want a grant, you want to understand more about the capacity investment scheme. What's the sort of the next hurdle that you've got to get over?
Well, I mean, I think that we see that we've got a significant role to play in bringing that firming infrastructure on. And so storage is absolutely at the heart of that. And we're currently working with a large number of developers and to assess what mix of assets can deliver us the least cost outcome on the firming side of the picture. But having said that, you know, we think that the cost of that, however which way we cut it, looks to be significantly in excess of what of the options that exist globally for other aluminium smelters. And that means that, you know, from a competitive perspective, our costs will be higher and much more volatile through the energy transition. And that means that, you know, we don't really see how a business can afford that in an environment where, you know, this industry makes very, very slim margins, right? And so really what we're talking about is, you know, sustaining the aluminium industry. We're going to have to continue to work with governments to find a way to do that and thus allow us to go ahead and keep adding more renewable projects and more firming projects into the portfolio to deliver that hedge in the market.
So an obvious project in Queensland, I suppose, that is of the same scale as the Boyne Island refinery is the Barumba Pumped Hydro project, is it not?
The Barumba project is a project that the Queensland government is backing in very hard, and we're continuing to work with the Queensland government to assess what firming options they may be able to provide us as part of their overall portfolio across their government-owned generators. So, but I think Barumba still has some years to go yet to its delivery. And pumped hydro projects in Australia have certainly seen a mix of different challenges in their delivery. So, but nevertheless, we're continuing to work with the Queensland government to see what they can do for us in that firming space.
Yes, indeed. And I guess in the meantime, the fact that there's I don't suppose the fact that you now have 5 terawatt hours or even a little more of renewable energy, that sort of takes some of the effort out of Gladstone and some of the risk away from the Gladstone Power Station. But I don't suppose its closure date, which I think I've always assumed is around 2028, is really going to change very much as a result of that. But it's an easier job for it, not having to run all the time, I suppose.
Well, I mean, look, the official closure date for Gladstone Power Station as filed with AEMO is 2035. We're continuing to work with all stakeholders to figure out, you know, what is the pathway to closure for Gladstone Power Station, and I think that's an area that we're continuing to do a fair bit of work on.
And so, Vic, I guess, do you already think about Tomago? But that's much more of a partnership effort. But I guess the people that own Tomago, which and Rio is the largest smelter, and I won't ask too many more questions because I'm sure this is an evolving question, but are they just going to look and see how you go in Queensland, or do you envisage a quite separate plan?
No, we're the majority shareholder in Tomago, and therefore we're working with the other joint venture partners that we have there in a similar way that we've worked with the joint venture partners that we've had at Boyne. You know, and so we will be in the market in Tomago. I think next week we're launching an RFP for Tomago, and we're very, very keen to go down a very similar process, assessing what projects exist in New South Wales that we can partner with to bring to the market, noting the unique challenges that, you know, you both have discussed at length around planning timelines and the like in New South Wales that may cause us to have to think more creatively about how we structure those contracts.
That's right, and I guess one of your partners at Tomago is Norsk Hydro, which has already done some significant work in Norway for its own smelters, but has the advantage of very cheap firming there. It's more like adding the wind to the hydro rather than adding the hydro to the wind.
Yes, I mean, Norway is blessed with lots of that legacy hydro, which provides very cheap firming, right? So, but you know, Norsk Hydro also have assets in Brazil that they've done some quite interesting and exciting work on, and so we're continuing to work with them and with the CSR, our other joint venture partner, on how we exactly, you know, run this process and bring projects to market, but. You know, we're absolutely all hands on deck trying to drive that forward.
I'm just wondering, Vic, just to sort of come in here. This, the nuclear debate has surfaced again in Australia in quite some way. It seems to be the sort of the central energy policy now for one political party. I mean, Rio Tinto, with its huge smelters, big energy demand, flat load and things like that, would surely be the pin-up boy for sort of nuclear technology. Is this something that you would like to be able to explore?
Look, I mean, thus far, nuclear hasn't been something that we've explored in great detail. And you know, the sort of point I'd like to make on a more macro level is, you know, we don't have a nuclear industry in Australia, and wherever the deployment of nuclear power has been successful globally in the last 70 years, you know, it's really been, you know, as a project, as a national project of national significance, with complete social and political alignment behind its deployment and long-term public and taxpayer commitment to it. You know, we think that certainly similar conditions would have to be true in Australia as well for that deployment. And as far as we can see, you know, all validated and independent data that exists on costs say that it's, you know, a very expensive source of energy. You know, and I think in Australia certainly we've got low-cost wind and solar, we're going to run with that footy.
Yeah. Vic, your background, I think, originally was in geology before you went to McKinsey and then to Rio. I want to ask, are you actually enjoying the challenge? And how do you find, because Rio is historically a traditional company, there must be a lot of different opinions about the this particular challenge. How are you finding it personally, and how do you think? Can you tell me about how Rio generally, the consensus at Rio about the whole thing?
Well, look, on a personal level, you know, this has been, I mean, one of those amazing challenges and tasks. That, you know, can be a person's life's work, really. You know, the 5 terawatt hours that you mentioned, you know, the abatement generated by that would be about 1% of Australia's national emissions. That's not a bad day in the office or 2.5 years in the office, in my case. So
it's a wonderful day at the office, but keep going.
Yeah. In terms of the consensus at Rio, look, I think we've got a really clear strategy. 50% emissions reductions by 2030 is what we've put forward to the market. We've got really strong executive and board commitment to that strategy, and we're continuing to deliver against that. You know, as we restated in our climate report recently. So I think we've got, you know, we've got all the right ingredients. We've got the right people. We've got the right capability. And we've got the right level of strategic clarity, but what we need to do to transform our business to be fit for a zero emissions future. So I'm really excited about the journey here thus far, and you know, continue to want to run with that, you know, for a long time to come.
We really do appreciate your time, and congratulations on your work so far, and look forward to hearing the next. The next stage.
I'd like to congratulate Rio. Really, companies like Rio send a big signal, like state governments and federal governments. It's an equivalent signal, and I think it's a real mark of the commitment of both Rio, but also how far the industry itself has come, that both parties can get on with this. So hope we do many more podcasts like this, and I'd like to thank Rio and Vic for speaking to us here at Energy Insiders.
Thanks, both. Bye.
And that was Vic Silveraja from Rio Tinto. David, pretty interesting stuff. Some interesting news there about new tenders coming up. Some observations about nuclear energy, but we probably kind of knew that. We might come to that subject later on. But it's really quite profound and important what Rio Tinto is doing here.
It is profound and important. It's like it's a great signal, as we discussed, for Rio to be actually taking this step here in Australia. I think it's great for the city of Gladstone and the smelter there, and potentially also going to be very interesting for Newcastle and Tomago. And so that's all wonderful, but it isn't enough in itself. You know, the wind and the solar plants, as we discussed, they're the easy bit. We know Australia has a great wind and solar energy resource, and we can produce as much as we need and a lot of other places need, but that doesn't in and of itself add up to the total package.
No, look, that's right. No, it was interesting, actually, today the Clean Energy Investors Group came out with a couple of reports from Nexa Advisory and Baringa Partners, sort of looking at the dispatchable energy and storage in particular. And it was interesting what they noted about the sort of the 1 to 2 hour storage market is kind of sort of looking after itself at the moment because the frequency markets have developed and the short-term sort of arbitrage markets have evolved. The hard bit is the sort of the medium to long term. The capacity investment scheme will obviously fill in partly for that. They say that more is required, you know, particularly for long duration storage. So it's going to be interesting to see what sort of things that that are proposed and come up with, and what sort of arrangements that Rio can come up with the state governments. I mean, what do you think they'll be asking for?
I have no idea, frankly, but it was interesting at the Smart Energy Conference, which we should come on to, which was a great conference, and you really have to congratulate John Grimes and the team there for the way they've grown the Smart Energy Council to be, I think, pretty close to the biggest event of the year in some ways. AEMO and several others spoke about we need 20 gigawatts of storage in the ISP, and we've only got 5 gigawatts now. Well, you know, we've actually got 5 gigawatts actually physically under construction right at this very second. And there'll be a lot more projects announced as the year goes on. So, and I think this evolution from the 1 to 2 hour thing is absolutely natural. It's what we've been saying, or what NREL, National Renewable Energy Labs, has been saying was the way it will go for a long, long time. And we are already seeing these tenders for longer duration storage from, say, the Altesas in New South Wales. So you know, the real question is around pumped hydro. At the Smart Energy Conference, Amy Keane and a number of others spoke about the need for pumped hydro. But the economics of pumped hydro are just still look very challenging, and the timelines as well.
Yeah, no, they do. And no one's actually found a way to sort of get these projects underway apart from sort of almost sort of total government financing. Snowy 2.0, of course, we know all about. Queensland is state owns its own generation and its utilities. So it's sort of planning on funding Burdekin and the Barumba pumped hydro schemes, which you mentioned in the discussion with Vic, although I don't think either of them can be delivered in time for Rio's purposes. And of course, Genex Power is building the Kidston pumped hydro power station, which will actually be the first new pumped hydro project to join the grid in 40 years. But that's been almost sort of totally funded and financed through various sort of government institutions. Hey, look, just on that, David, I mean, I just noticed that J-Power, their partner in the wind project and the big Bulleye Creek solar and battery project, has sort of lobbed a bid just over a year after Scott Farquhar had a go and didn't quite get there. I don't know. I mean, it'll be sad to lose another listed company. We actually get some interesting details about the wind and solar industry there, but I don't know whether you've got any other observations on that.
No, well, the observation is that it's very hard to run a listed renewable company because the projects require a lot of capital and produce. They don't have a lot of big upside cases generally. Maybe you could get one with a battery. What you get is an infrastructure style return, and the stock market's not, other than say toll roads, has been slow to really embrace infrastructure style assets that's more suited to the to the private market, which appreciates the matching of the liabilities. But the one thing I will say is that the Genix team have done very well. They started with nothing and basically, you know, big borrowed and stole their way up to having quite a decent asset portfolio.
We'll formally retract the stolen allegation, but anyway, keep going.
Yes, of course we will. They only moved the share price in the whole process a little way, and you know, you just can't be a small player developing giant projects. There comes a time when big projects require big companies, big corporate backers, and you know, yeah. I think that was the case for Genix.
Yeah, no, that's right. Yeah, and look, I'd also just observe Neoen, which is the French renewable energy developer and probably the biggest and most successful storage developer in Australia, and probably one of the most successful wind and solar developers as well. I mean, they struggled with their share price. I think last year they unveiled this sort of their big strategy of getting to 10 gigawatts by, I can't remember what date it was now, whether it was 2025 or 2030, and they were quite sort of shocked when their share price went down. Went, hey, hang on, that wasn't supposed to happen. But it is, because it's, you know, that appetite for those assets. Look, just one thing that I'd observe too, Red Earth was in the news because Chris Bowen revealed that he'd been at the Smart Energy Conference last year and had stopped off at the stand, and we'd been following around at the time and took a photo, and he'd gone off and bought one of their batteries, which is great support for an Australian storage company. But unfortunately, another storage company, Redback is into administration.
It's not, no longer on the toilet seat, it's gone straight down the toilet.
Very good. It's hard for Australian manufacturers, isn't it, despite the fact that the Australian government and the industry would wish that we can manufacture a lot of our solar and batteries and a whole bunch of other things here.
It's a lot easier to do advanced manufacturing when you're an academic or a government department than it is in practice when you've got to deal with the fact that people are importing stuff at cheap prices, often with some advantage or another, and having the advantage of, you know, very big markets that they can access. And I've always felt that people underestimate how hard it is to do manufacturing in Australia, and they look at the way they want things, the way they think things should be, rather than looking at what's actually happening. And for instance, Australia is very good at manufacturing agricultural style products and selling them to Asia because we've got comparative advantage there, and we've developed a whole chain of skills. And similarly, we're very good at finance. We're absolutely brilliant at resource extraction, and which is not low tech resource. You know, those mines are run by robot trains, robot trucks. They're extremely highly automated enterprises, as skilled as making, say, a Tesla car probably is, but they don't get the credit for it. But trying to be something that we're not is always going to be a difficult job. But anyway, no doubt someone will. We're good at software. We can make. One of the presentations I heard at Smart Energy was about a new coating for a new thing to do with solar panels, and I think maybe that can be a great thing, but will it be manufactured in Australia?
I'm not too sure. Look, it was interesting on that line. Danny Kennedy was, I thought, one of the most interesting speakers. He spoke on the Thursday morning in the session with Simon Holmes of Court and the Federal Energy Minister, Chris Bowen, who also delivered a terrific speech, and we'll come to that in a moment. But Danny Kennedy's suggestion was that if Australia want to get involved or get a good share of this renewable energy transition and all the things that might go with it, sort of, you know, green steel and green hydrogen and all that sort of stuff, really got to think big about this, and throwing a billion here and a billion there doesn't really cut it. They've got to really be thinking in the tens of billions or whatever, just sort of saying that it's got to compete, because there's a lot of capital flashing around the place, but it's got a lot of interesting places to go to, and if Australia does not set itself up to attract that capital, and it may need a lot of government sort of support and incentives and sort of commitment, then it may well pass us by. And I think that's been a reasonably consistent message. Chris Bowen.
But Charles, you can't just throw billions of dollars at it. It's like a big drug company, ethical drugs, saying we'll just spend lots and lots on R&D and we'll come up with some new wonder drug. It doesn't work like that. What you have to work out is what you can possibly actually be good at. And we haven't had a good answer to that so far. It's not, you're saying you can make green steel in Australia. I mean, it's just not that easy. You know, the steel markets are not in Australia. You have to ship the finished product a long way. It's hard enough in the aluminium where we've always had a comparative advantage, and you still got to compete against, you know, subsidised Chinese aluminium, which is produced in vast, vast quantities. We need to have a much clearer view of how we're going to progress down this path than I've seen from anyone so far.
Well, fair enough comment. Chris Bowen spent much of his time talking about two subjects, the vehicle emission standards, which is evolved into a very interesting and typically sort of partisan debate about they're going to steal your ute, or ute's going to get a lot more expensive. But it's interesting seeing some of the moves by the likes of Tesla, Polestar, VW and Hyundai sort of backing away from the main car lobby. The other thing which has really sort of caught the attention is this nuclear debate and the federal coalition just sort of running out with its nuclear plan, which really, I mean, any energy expert in Australia just knows is just absolutely, well, it's just bonkers, basically. I mean, it's slow. It doesn't respond to the science. It's expensive. Small modular reactors don't exist, and no one's got an application or is building one. Large-scale nuclear reactors, you know, in all our Western countries and even with our AUKUS partners, you know, barely any have been built in the last three decades, and they've run well over time and three times and four times over budget. But it's extraordinary the amount of running he gets in mainstream media. I mean, they just seem to be, I don't know. I mean, maybe they just like the political fight, but they don't seem to care about the technology and the facts.
Well, look, the first thing I'd like to do is to congratulate Chris Bowen and the Labor Party in this case for bringing in the vehicle efficiency standards, which are long, long overdue in Australia. I think it is a legitimate question to ask, having left it for so long, we're so far behind Europe and the United States now. It is a reasonable question to ask how we can't get there in 1 year. Can we even get there in 5 years? But to have the political courage to bring that in as a sensible policy that will actually achieve something, that's great. On the other hand, we have the Queensland branch of the LNP advocating for nuclear, and we have mainstream political journalists who are taken very seriously, the likes of, say, Philip Khoury at the Financial Review, and who just look at the politics of it and pay no attention to the actual economic reality. I think it's a disgrace the way mainstream media cover this story. I think it's a disgrace for the LNP to be advocating a policy which is completely and utterly unrealistic in any sensible discussion. And it's just an example. There are two other points to make. You can sell, if people want to believe something, then you can do a con job on them. If people want to believe you can get rich quickly, and that people always do want to believe that, then a con man can take advantage of it. And that's exactly what the Queensland LNP is doing. People want to believe in nuclear energy, and so they do. But there's also this thing, one of the reasons they want to believe it is because people have this psychological fear, and maybe it's not psychological, but they just genuinely haven't been had it explained to them clearly enough that we can run the system on wind and solar and storage. We in the industry know that that can be done, but I don't believe the general public, they may sort of read it, but they haven't internalized it and accepted that. And I think this is the job for the federal government as well, to actually sell the ISP, quite frankly. It's not that Chris Bowen doesn't believe in the ISP or whoever, but it hasn't been sold to the public in a way that they completely embody it. And so they are going to dismiss the nuclear thing because they see what all of us insiders see of how unnecessary it is.
Hmm.
Couldn't agree more, David. Look, I think that's probably enough for this week. It's been a great, had a great interview with Vic Silveraja from Rio Tinto. Really appreciated your comments on the Smart Energy Council and nuclear and all the other things, David. And look, just like to thank our sponsors, Pylon and Evergen, and all the listeners out there. It was good walking around the Smart Energy Council last week and getting a lot of really positive feedback from people. Always very gratifying. So we'll be back with another episode of the Energy Insiders podcast very, very soon. We might even double up this week, depending on commitments, if we have something important enough to bring you. But anyway, bye for now.
Energy Insiders was brought to you by Evergen, the market-leading renewable energy software business that optimises residential and commercial solar and battery systems. Evergen enables large numbers of systems to operate as a single fleet, so network operators can use them as a virtual power plant, generating significant value for consumers, network operators, and the energy system as a whole. Evergen software is powering the energy system of the future. Energy Insiders was also brought to you by Pylon. Pylon provides easy-to-use solar design software for installers and retailers with pay-as-you-go pricing, no monthly cost, and no locking contracts. Join Australia's top solar companies who trust Pylon to design high-resolution, CEC-ready solar proposals.